Well, last week I introduced Ravi Zacharias to you, told you a little bit about his background and his salvation experience and how God's used his life to develop a apologetics ministry, and left off with several questions that kind of left you hanging on the answers. And I was thinking maybe you just wait until next week to answer these. No, I was just teasing. Dave was able to download some actual video of Robbie. So what we're going to do today is look at, I think we can get four questions in. And we've got video of him on three of them. And one of them I can just kind of explain, you know, the kind of answers I've heard from him. But these are the kind of questions that are going to kind of come up over and over again when you're talking with people who have objections to Christianity. And we're going to look at a couple different questions. The first one is asked by a person, and the reason I picked this first one is because it's really not asked sincerely. It's asked sarcastically. And he gets this oftentimes from people who ask questions. They're really not looking for an answer. They're looking for a way to tear down Christianity. And that's kind of what happens in this first question. And you can just sense the smart-alecky kind of attitude that this fella has as he's basically asking Ravi, why do we have to have God? Why can't we just get along? Why do you insist that there is a need for God in order for mankind to get along? His proposition is, I don't need God. I'm not going to go out and murder anybody. I get along fine with people. Why do I need God? That's kind of the question. It's asked in kind of a smart-alecky way. And I want you to watch and see how the question's answered, how he deals with this kind of person. And I just find it interesting. This is, I believe this is done at a college campus. But Dave, if you have the one that says, what are you afraid of? That's the first one. Let's hear the...
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Let's leave aside Christianity and historical examples for a second. All night you guys have been grappling with issues like morality and, you know, what is right, what is wrong, and meaning. But my question is simply, why are you so afraid of subjective moral reasoning? I mean, do you think that we're all just going to start raping and pillaging just because we don't have a book to tell us what to do? I mean, are you afraid of that? Like, I'm not, because that's not going to happen. And that, yeah, Nazis were bad, but there were Christian Nazis and there were atheist Nazis. So I don't see... What are you so afraid of?
Stop it just for a second, Dave.
Do you lock your door at night?
Back it up just a little bit. You heard the question. Think for just a second. How would you answer that question? Because it's a tough question to answer. I'm always, when I hear these questions, I always pause it before I hear his answer and say, now how would I answer that question? And I never can come up close to what he says. But listen how he systematically takes the principles of this question and leads this fellow down the road of truth. Okay, Dave.
It's Nazis. So I don't see... What are you so afraid of?
Do you lock your door at night?
Yeah. Sure.
You know, I hear what you're saying. Sounds very cavalier, though. My goodness. If we weren't afraid of all of this, we would not be in a national debt. The billions...
China is secular.
Sorry?
China is secular.
Sorry?
China is secular.
That's right. What does that mean?
I mean, they're not raping and pillaging, and neither are we.
Oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my. Oh my. Have you read what happened during the Red Guards Rebellion? Have you read what happened during the Boxer Rebellion? Do you know who has killed more people in the 20th century than China and Russia? 60 million apiece? Wow. It makes the Holocaust seem tame. The 20th century became the bloodiest century in history. And the reason it became the bloodiest century in history, I can see, is you could just see the weapons of our warfare were piling up and there was no guiding principle to take us anywhere. Now, in a perfect world, yes, we don't need to be afraid. Have you seen what happens in our courts of law, where people supposedly love each other and all that comes about in hate and vitriol and damage? I don't think the question is fairly stated as what are you afraid of. I'm just saying it is basically unlivable. I didn't conclude that. An atheist like Jean-Paul Sartre concluded it. We killed more people in the 20th century than the previous 19 put together. And your question is, what are we afraid of? The fact of the matter is, if morality is purely subjective, then you have absolutely nothing from stopping anybody for being a subjective moralist to choose to just zing one through your forehead and say, that's my answer. You know, how do you stop that? Obviously, you don't believe that's the way it should be, neither do I. So it's not a case of what am I afraid of, it's a case of the fact that if you're willing to say to me that moral reasoning can be purely subjective, I just say to you, look out, you ain't seen nothing yet if everybody believed what you did. Do you know, funny, interesting, when I was in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, Stalin eliminated 15 million of his own people. 15 million of his own people. And at the Center for Geopolitical Strategy, you know, they didn't want to even name his name and so on. His daughter, Svetlana, made the comment, it is quoted both by Malcolm Muggeridge in his writings and by historian Paul Johnson in Modern Times. Svetlana was standing by the bedside of her father before he died. She said the last thing he did was clench his fist over the heavens one more time, put his head back on the pillow, and he was gone. This is his daughter raising the question, whatever got into my father to have that kind of hatred and hostility? And when 15 million were killed of his own people, it is interesting that the faculty members and the general who chatted with me there, my wife will tell you, sat around the table with tears in his eyes when he watched what had been done to his own country by his own leadership. So subjective morality would be very good if we all wanted to be nice people and live around each other without any fear of each other. But the reason you lock your doors and the reason we have our police and the reason we have our military and the reason we have our law courts is because when subjective morality becomes totally subjectivized, this is what happens in society. So it's a great idea, but I hope nobody absorbs it. Thank you. We go on to the next one there. Thank you.
Okay. Good answer. He took the fellow's example of the Soviet Union and use that very example to show that subjective morality just doesn't work if there isn't God behind it. If we're left to our own devices, we're going to basically deteriorate into some kind of anarchy, or at least some kind of government control. So I thought that was good. I liked the way he responded to the fellow. He wound up coming back and answering his question specifically, but he used the very examples that the young man used to support his argument, to defeat the argument. So that was the first one. Now the next one we're going to look at is a question asked by a young lady. And this one's a little more detailed, a little longer, but she's asking about Christianity versus feminism. And she was sharing with a friend of hers, a girlfriend of hers, who rejected Christianity because of she thought the Bible was too hard on women. On this one, I want you to, we'll stop again after the question's asked, Dave, and just to let the question sink in for a second and to see how you would answer it and respond to it. But this girl is asking the question sincerely. She really wants to know because she wants to be able to share with her, I think, roommate or whatever, a good answer. So he has a different approach. He does a little more, a little softer in his explaining, and yet gives a very good, detailed answer to it. So let's hear the question first.
One of my closest friends is an atheist, and I've asked her why she is, and she told me that she's read the doctrines of many theologies, including Christianity, and as soon as she got to the part in the Bible where she read about Adam and Eve, and they said, or it said, that woman shall suffer the pain of childbirth for the sin of Eve, she told me, I stopped reading because I refuse to believe in something that doesn't believe in me. What would be your response to her?
Okay.
You hear the question. Her friend thinks that the Bible's basically too hard on women. And she could have even added to that. She could have said that, you know, part of the curse was that the woman's desire would be for the man. And she may have found that offensive too. She didn't mention it, but it would go along with the same question. But I was really impressed in this one with how he breaks down the question and looks at the intent of the questioner and then gives very precise answer. I don't know if you've got your answer in your mind yet on how you would respond to that. It's kind of a difficult question. But it's something that's being asked more and more often in this generation where the feminist movement is getting more and more aggressive and stronger. So let's hear what he has to say.
Okay. When a person rejects a certain worldview, you have to respect, if they're being honest, why they reject it. And if I were sitting across a table with her, I would think she's a woman with a tender conscience, a woman who has personal worth, and a woman who says, if this is the way I'm described, there's no place for me here. So if her deduction is correct, one can validate the objection. But if the discussion, if the deduction is incorrect, then she has to change her view. First, she has to know what it is she has adopted while she has rejected something else. I remember I was speaking at the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Russia, full of atheists. And God gave me the privilege actually of seeing the general come to Christ, so he invited me to speak there, but he says they'll be pretty hostile. And they sure were. They were going like this the whole time I was talking. And at the Q&A time, one guy, the fellow kept going like this, shot his arm up in the air and stood up and he said, you've been talking about God the whole time. He said, what on earth are you talking about? Well, the question logically to answer him was, are you an atheist? Yes. What is it you're denying? What is it you're denying? So when a woman or a man says they are denying the existence of God, what are they affirming in its place? She is actually affirming that this God or religion is not true. Atheism is. But if atheism is true, she has no value. If atheism is true, there's not even a point of reference for her worth. We are the product of primordial slime. Time plus matter plus chance, the accidental collocation of atoms, here we are. A blip on the radar screen, a screen of time. That's exactly what Bertrand Russell said, that this whole edifice is doomed to extinction. We are here by cosmic accident. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, first she reduces her own worth to nothing but material. Secondly, she's making a moral judgment. But in an amoral universe, how do you invoke a moral judgment? If this is a naturalistic framework, why is it morally wrong for God to say you're not of any worth? But it's because she's invoking a moral law and she's invoking worth.
which basically tells me she's actually borrowing from the Judeo-Christian worldview in order to debunk it. All right, now here's the point. You never take a word out of context. You always put it in its larger context. You know, when Jesus saw the woman who was taken in adultery, he really let him have it. Where's the man? Where are her accusers? The guys never brought the man. He was gone somewhere. She obviously didn't commit adultery with herself. You were living at a time in a culture then where this kind of thing happened so often. He writes some letters in the sand and he says to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." The woman with the alabaster ointment, in that culture, for her to have even touched him was audacious. And yet, the Pharisees sitting there said, if Jesus only knew who this woman was, he would not have had her have any part in him. And he said to them, you know, guys, what she has done to me is going to be told all over the world where the gospel is preached. And he received her gift. When I was in Albania last year, they sat me down in the museum and brought the Greek translation of Chrysostom of the New Testament. And I looked at the passage where this woman with the alabaster ointment had poured it on Jesus. Her story is told where the gospel is all over the world. When he revealed himself in the resurrection, he went completely against the climate and the culture of the time. He revealed himself first to the women who had come to the tomb, whose testimony was not even valuable in court at that time. So if you see the special place he gives to womanhood and the glory that he has crowned, the charm and the mystique of womanhood is both in its intellect and in its mystique. Today, if you were to take women writers, they touch the nerve of reality much better often than men did. I think of people like women like Dorothy Sayers and all of them. Brilliant, brilliant writers. What has happened, unfortunately, is the way our cultures have oppressed always find somebody to oppress. And as a result, we read that verse in a vacuum and we don't read it all the way, the rest of the way. When you see him highlighting people like Sarah, people like Ruth, people like Deborah, and in the New Testament, you see the names of Phoebe and the names of Mary and all writ large, you see that he tells a man to love a woman the way Christ loved the church. That is the greatest compliment he ever paid you or me, that you were as valuable and you are as valuable as humanity is to him. There is neither Jew nor Greek, nor male nor female, the Apostle Paul writes. So tell her, please don't read that out of context. Read the whole thing. Your reaction would be right if that's all that it's... what it says there is this. Remember, where there is a plurality of the miracle in physical acts, there is also a plurality of judgment in physical expression. You will see this in Exodus, you'll see this in Genesis. Where there's dramatic miracles, there are dramatic judgments as well. And that sin has a cost, and we always remember through this from whence we came. And the glory is through the seed of that woman, he was going to bring the Redeemer ultimately. And I think that is what grace is all about. She should not read it in a vacuum. Tell her to take a good look at Christ and see his treatment of women. And I think she'll find out that there is no other worldview, again, I repeat, no other worldview that gives the respect to womanhood that Jesus does. Okay.
Okay, good. You see how systematically he goes through and answers the question and gives her something to think about. If you just look at that one verse in Genesis that she was talking about, it sounds like God doesn't care about women, but he goes through the whole Bible and shows how valued women are to God, and especially Jesus himself took the time to break so many traditions to honor women. The other thing that he said at the end of that, which I want to focus on a little bit, is he said, where there are dramatic miracles, there are dramatic consequences. And this is where a lot of the criticism of the Bible comes from. They point to the dramatic consequence while ignoring the dramatic miracle. For instance, in the New Testament, when who were the two, was it Ananias and Sapphira, that were killed by lying, because they lied about holding back some money from the sale of a piece of property. Now, a lot of people would look at that and say, they're giving money to the church. Just because they didn't give it all, God's going to kill them? I mean, that's a criticism. But it was a dramatic consequence. What was the dramatic event? It was the beginning of the church. And God wanted to start his church out in purity and in holiness. And it was the beginning of the Holy Spirit acting within the church. So these are such an important historical event that it required dramatic consequences if somebody violated the very rules that God was trying to set out. You know, same thing like he said in the Old Testament. He told the people in the first battle, don't keep any of the goods for yourself. And you remember the guy Achan decided to keep some gold for himself. And what happened? God opened up the earth and swallowed him and his whole family. And you say, well, that's cruel. Why punish the family and the animals and all that stuff? It's because it was a dramatic consequence to a dramatic event in time. It was the beginning of a nation. He said, you're going to go out being conquering people. You're a brand new nation. I want holiness. I want you to follow my word. Do exactly what I said. I only gave you one rule. Don't take anything this time. In the future, they were going to be able to take things. So it's a common complaint against the Bible, is that God does all these horrible things, when in reality, he's oftentimes creating a new movement that he wants to be very pure. Okay, now before we get to the third one, let me jump in, and I couldn't find this one on video or a short enough version to play. But another common question, and probably the most common question that's asked in these types of events, is something that says like this: if there is a God, why is there so much evil transpiring in the world, so much violence, so much death and mayhem? That's a question he gets almost every time, every place that he goes. And it's really a two-part question. And if you get this kind of question, I think it's best to break it down into two parts, because a person who says this is really making two statements, and you want to be able to separate these two statements so you can answer them correctly, because otherwise you might be answering the first part of the statement, and he's focusing on the second part of the statement. And here are the two statements separated would go like this. The first one would say, I don't believe there is a God because of the existence of evil. That's one thing that could be interpreted from that statement. And the second thing that could be interpreted from it is somebody saying, there very well may be a God, but I don't think God is fair because he allows so much evil in the world. Both of those statements can be homogenized into that general statement. So you want to find out which of those two questions the person is asking. Are they saying I'm an atheist because of the existence of evil in the world? Or are they saying I'm an agnostic, or I want to try a different religion, a different God, because I don't like your view of God because of all the evil that's in the world? You haven't given me a satisfactory explanation for the evil in the world. So you look at those two questions separately and take the two apart and look at them individually. The first part would be there cannot be a God because of the evil that's in the world. That would be the first part. And this can be answered like he did with the girl. He said she's using a Christian reference to prove that there is no God. And it's the same thing here. For instance, in order for there to be objective evil in the world, you also have to know or see objective good in the world. You cannot define evil without showing good. And if that's a hard thing for you to grasp, think of it this way. Try to describe the color red to somebody who's born blind. How can you do that? There is no point of reference. You can't, you don't have a starting point because that person doesn't know what colors are. It's the same way with good and evil. There has to be good in order for us to recognize evil. That's the first point. The second point is that there has to be some sort of objective moral law so as to define the difference between good and evil. It's like in a football game. How much is the penalty for offsides? It's 5 yards. We know that. That's an objective law in football. It's been determined that if you jump offsides, it's a 5-yard penalty. There's no subjectiveness to it. And who determines whether or not you jump offsides? You can't rely on the fans because the home team is always going to go with the home team. The home team crowd is always going to pull for the home team. Visitors are going to pull for the visitors. You have to have somebody on the field who ostensibly is objective. Now, sometimes we get mad at the referees too. But his job is to be objective and to look and see who jumps off sides. Was it the offense or was it the defense? And assign the penalty. It's the same way with moral law. There is evil. There has to be, if there is evil, there has to be good. If there's good and evil, there has to be a moral line. And there has to be somebody to determine whether the act you committed was a good act or an evil act. So we call this the moral law, the objective moral lawgiver. So if there is an objective moral lawgiver, then there has to be God. That's the only one that can be an objective moral lawgiver. So it begs the question, when you go back to there cannot be a God because there is evil, you're using God's law and you're using God to defeat your own argument. You just have to think that one through a little bit till it clicks or makes sense. But they people who claim that are claiming that there is some objective evil out there and they don't like it and it doesn't feel right. Well, that very feeling that they get comes because they recognize the difference between good and evil. And therefore, they recognize that there is an objective moral authority who determines good and evil. It's not just their subjective feeling of what's right and wrong. Inherently, we know things are right and we're not, and are wrong, and are things that are right and wrong. So that would be the way you would kind of answer the first part of that question. Is there evil? Because there's so much evil, there cannot be a God. No, evil itself proves that there is a God. If there were no God, you wouldn't believe in evil. Like he said, if we're the objects of time and chance and matter, then there is no moral code. Everybody can do what they want to do, and there's no God who infused us with a conscience and with an ability to determine right and wrong. So that would be the first part, the way you'd answer the question. If, on the other hand, they're saying, I don't think God is fair. I recognize there's God, but I reject him because it's not fair that there's so much evil in the world. Well, that too falls apart if you kind of dissect what they're saying. I would ask somebody like that, well, we know that there were like 12 million people killed in the Holocaust. Would you feel God is unfair because of that? And they'd probably say, yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You say, well, would you feel better if it was only 6 million people killed instead of 12? Would you think God would be fair then? I don't know what their answer to that would be, but they would scratch their head a little bit. And if you worked it down to 1 million or 500,000 or 2,000 or 1,000, would they still say that God is not fair? I don't know. We only react to the facts that we know. We don't look a little deeper and say, what are the other options? What else could God have done? And would I be satisfied with a lower number? if a school bus got hit by a train and 12 children, let's say, were killed in a school bus accident, and we say, where was God? Why couldn't he have made this not happen? Why do these 12 children have to die? Well, what if only six died? Would you have the same complaint of God? Some people would. Some people would complain if it was one child. The only way in their mind that God could be fair would be eliminate the ability for bad things to happen. That's the only way in their mind. Because if nobody had ever died since the beginning of time in a tragic way, so therefore there was no complaints of God, and only maybe one person, let's just say one person, in the history of time was killed brutally, raped, murdered, whatever. If that person had a reference to you, you would shake your fist at God and say, you're not being fair, God. So we really put God in a box, and we create an impossible situation where no matter what he does, no matter how much carnage is not seen, and who knows how much carnage is not seen, we have no idea. But because of what we do see, we put God in a box. And we say, you're not fair. You are allowing this evil. That's not a fair, you can't do that to God, because the only way he can get out of your box is for nobody to do anything wrong and cause any death, any pain, any suffering. Well, if he did that, if God said, okay, we'll do it your way, there will not be any pain, suffering, death, or whatever, that would reduce us to nothing less than robots, because we would not have the free will to do things that he didn't want us to do. And there's the rub. The very thing that we complain of now is God not being fair. We would then complain, God, you're not letting me do what I want to do. I don't want to go to church. I don't want to do this or do that. I want to do this bad thing, and you're not letting me do it. You're not giving me free will. You're not being fair to me. The very people who now complain about God being allowing evil would complain that God would not allow them free will. And that's the box that they paint God into. So that's kind of the way I would answer that question about the evil in the world existing as being an objection to the existence of God or the niceness of God. So that's going to take us back to the last video. Now, this one is somebody who classifies himself as an atheist and a scientist, and he starts out by demeaning the Christian faith. And
hello,
I wonder who that was. And he really starts kind of letting Ravi have it as far as belittling his faith, really. And I want you to see how he, in this particular video, how he turns this around on the guy. This guy starts out his question being aggressively against Christians and thinking we're all stupid. Watch how, throughout the answer to the question, watch how he, and this is one of the mysteries that Ravi has, he's able to kind of win this guy over and get this guy to soften, I think is probably the best word. So watch and see how he does it.
Hello, my name is Ethan Kaiser. I am a scientist and an atheist. And my question is, since the Bible has been scientifically disproven as far as all the claims, you know, through evolution, the theory of evolution, archaeology, you know, Noah's Ark, Adam and Eve, since we know this didn't happen because of our science nowadays, my question is, how do we have, according to the Bible, how do we have free will if God is this omniscient being that knows everything about us, everything we will do, and he pretty much knows our outcome before we're even created? So he creates us knowing everything we'll do. Since we can't surprise him by our actions, we have no free will. Our choices have been predetermined, and that the act of judgment is completely immoral because he knows what we're going to do. Nothing can surprise him. That's my question.
Okay. Tough question to answer, isn't it? And it's really kind of two different things. First, he's saying Christianity isn't true. And then he's saying that if you assume it's true, then there's another logical fault in it, and that is our free will. And that is a question that even we as Christians sometimes struggle with, the predestination, you know, the difference between our free will and the predestination of God. And I like the way Ravi handles it. First, he handles the first part of the question, and then he'll come back and handle the second one. But think about your answer. How do you respond to a person like that who's just belittled your faith, and then he's going to say that the weakness of your faith is that you don't have the free will to do anything? Okay.
Thank you for the question. And before you go into an auditorium, if you give a sheet of paper and ask us to write 20 possible questions, that'll come. We've never heard a new one in all of these years that go by. They're pretty much the same questions. It's interesting that you began by saying, as an atheist, all of this has been disproved, and so you live with scientific materialism as your worldview. I studied under John Polkinghorne at Cambridge University. You probably know the name. One of the world's leading quantum physicists who came to exactly the opposite conclusion you did while being the dean at Queen's College, Cambridge, as a quantum physicist, taking the same data you did. So obviously, for a man of his intellectual ability to come to a different conclusion, one would either have to say he's totally stupid to come to that conclusion, or else his empirical basis. Please don't keep shaking your head. Let me finish so that you can come and talk afterwards. So he allows to concentrate what we're saying here. I want to read for you what David Berlinsky says about the scientific naturalistic worldview. Do you know who he is?
No.
One of the world's leading physicists who is an agnostic, borders on atheism, but took issue with Richard Dawkins's book, The God Delusion, and wrote a book called The Devil's Delusion. Here's what he said. Has anyone ever provided proof of God's inexistence? Not even close. Has quantum cosmology explained the emergence of the universe or why it is here? Not even close. Have the sciences explained why our universe seems to be fine-tuned to allow for the existence of life? Not even close. This is Berlinsky talking. Are physicists and biologists willing to believe in anything as long as it is not enough, not religious thought? Close enough. Has rationalism and moral thought provided us with an understanding of what is good, what is right, and what is moral? Not close enough. Has secularism in the terrible 20th century been a force for good? Not even close to being close. Is there a narrow and oppressive orthodoxy of thought and opinion within the sciences? Close enough. Does anything in the sciences or in their philosophy justify the claim that religious belief is irrational? Not even in the ballpark. Is scientific atheism a frivolous exercise in intellectual contempt? Dead on. Now, I didn't say that, all right? I'm not quoting myself. Please give me your name, sir.
Ethan?
Yes. Ethan, what you're wrestling with is not uncommon. Many people from a scientific and materialistic worldview will say what you've said and come to that conclusion. The problem is what you mispositioned was your concern between determinism and free will. Your application could have gone in many different directions, but you came to that one for some reason, which I was unfortunate, I think. At Cambridge, I listened to a talk at the Lady Mitchell Hall in 1990 by Stephen Hawking. As you know, he can't speak. He uses a speech synthesizer. His whole talk was on determinism and freedom. And you know what he concluded? That the tragedy with scientific materialism, if we take its assumptions, is that we are not free, we are totally determined. That was the world's leading physicist at that time saying, the very thing you're asking of the Christian faith, he pinned on your backs as scientific materialists. You can go right online and trace it. Lady Mitchell Hall, 1990, somewhere on March, April, May, that time I was in attendance. And he said, the only escape I have is since I don't know what has been determined, I may as well not be. The whole auditorium moaned and groaned with an escape hatch that he gave for himself after telling us that we were completely determined. That's Berlinsky's issue. That is actually even what people like Dawkins will concede, or Pinker. You read Steven Pinker and the others. So totally determined. So the question is, were you free to ask this question? Yep.
I I don't believe any of us actually have free will because we are strictly material.
So you're actually, as a machine automaton, asking me this question?
We are all made up of our past experiences.
Okay, but you're not free then. You're not free. You're not making a truth statement.
My truth statement. I mean, what I'm saying is our memories and our states.
No. Hear me carefully.
Okay.
If you're totally determined,
yes,
you're pre-wired to think the way you do.
Nature versus nurture, yes.
Sorry?
Nature versus nurture.
Right. Nature versus nurture.
Yes.
Regardless, okay, the nurture may provide a different environment, but
sure,
the nature is you're hardwired,
yes,
to come out to the same conclusion. Out of flux, nothing but flux. You know, what you put into the computer, ultimately is going to come out. But you have to ask yourself, are you making a truth claim? If you are making a truth claim, you're rising above the bondage of total subjectivity. And the moment you claim a truth claim, you're violating determinism. And so I just leave you with that.
Okay.
And let's meet afterwards. Hey, Ethan, we want to chat with you. You know, you're the kind of guy we come here for. So afterwards, you come here and we'll chat with you. Come here, give me a shake hand. Bless you, brother. Thanks, buddy. Thank you.
That's good, Dave.
You know, I live in a condominium where there's so much of noise that sometimes goes on, and I phoned the property manager and said, you know, when I write, the sound of anything distracts me. And so she said, play some music. I said, what? Yeah. So that's why I'm sorry if I checked you on the shaking of the head. If I get distracted, I can't stay on track, you know, so my apologies on that.
You see how he kind of won the guy over by not being offensive to him, but yet in detail he responded to the guy's worldview. The guy was making a truth claim. When he says we are predestined, then he's above himself recognizing that he's predestined. That's a truth claim. You can't make a truth claim if you're predestined already. So it's just, I find him to be very intellectual, answers questions at any level that anybody can understand, and does it in a friendly way, and doesn't offend the people that he answers. So I wanted to show you a few of those to give you an idea. I want to kind of whet your appetite. I want you to look this guy up. You can see lots of his stuff on YouTube. Just type his name in, Ravi Zacharias. Like I said, he has a Sunday night broadcast on the Christian radio station, 106.92. And I just, to me, he's just a very special kind of person. So that's why I wanted to use him as one of our heroes of the faith this year, and hope that for those of you who did not know about him, that you would discover a real gem that we have walking among us today. He's not going to be around too much longer. He's already in his 70s, and he's not in great health. So I want you to enjoy him while you can. A great man. I sometimes he has something in Charlotte, and the next time we know of some event that he's got, we'll let you know. Maybe we can get a group come over and listen to him, because he's just an amazing type of person. So that's Ravi Zacharias. And next week what we'll do is get back into Acts, where we left off in Acts, but I wanted you to experience a little bit about this very special person. So we'll close in prayer now. Father, thank you for this man of God that you have set before us as an example of how to have a heart for evangelism and at the same time have a mind to be able to defend your faith, defend our faith through the truths that you have put in the Bible. He's a remarkable example for us. I pray for good health for Ravi. He's in his 70s now, and pray that you would continue to keep his mind clear and keep his body strong so that he can continue to minister for you and to bless us in the Christian body. Pray that we would learn from him, learn about how to defend our faith ourselves so that we can be able to respond to questions that people have to us. So we thank you for his testimony, his life, and we thank you for our opportunity to come together today as a church. I thank you for giving us enough of a break in the weather that we could be here today. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.